When she was still very young, Artress read these words from a novel by James Baldwin, and they spoke to her. I look at myself in the mirror. I know that I was christened Clementine, and so it would make sense if people called me Clem, or even, come to think of it, Clementine, since that's my name. But they don't. People call me Tish. I guess that makes sense, too. I'm tired, and I'm beginning to think that maybe everything that happens makes sense. Like, if it didn't make sense, how could it happen? But that's really a terrible thought. It can only come out of trouble, trouble that doesn't make sense. The very first words of Baldwin's novel, If Beale Street Could Talk, have everything to do with identity. The character Clementine looks in the mirror, asking who she is. She knows her name is Clementine. That's how she came into this world. So why do people call her by a name that isn't even related to her real name? And as Clementine poses that question, we come to understand that she is really, deep down, trying to make sense, not just of who she is, but she needs to make sense of life itself. The power of names, the power to name, has been very important to Artress White in her own life, and so has what she's read. She told Linda Perry of the University of Kentucky Alumni Magazine that her parents had a bookshelf that she also considered her first little library. They had some writers and books that intrigued me on their shelf. The two that stand out for me now, I was reading above my age level, were James Baldwin's If Beale Street Could Talk and Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. I read them when I was very young, and the things I didn't understand, I skipped over, she says. What resonated with me, though, was that these were stories of African Americans that I could identify with. I believe that's where my interest in storytelling began. We know Artress was encouraged to write by an English teacher in high school after reading a story she'd written about two ballet dancers, one black like herself and the other white. But as we'll soon learn, the power of the stories she heard from her family as she was growing up were foundational. She was entrusted by her mother with a story that got to the very heart of her own identity as a member of that family. It was an oral slave narrative which revealed that she was descended from a Scottish immigrant named Peter Hairston and had a mixed race ancestry. She knew the truth of the story because, as we'll learn, she could read it in the very face of her mother. And how fascinating that when she was still in high school, Artress created a story about two ballet dancers, one black and one white. And we can imagine that they may have danced together in telling a special story in their ballet, a real story ballet she created. It's an evocative image as we learn more about Dr. Artress White, an award-winning author and associate professor of English at East Stroudsburg University. She has published books of poetry and essays and a tribute to poet Phyllis Wheatley. Just released this month on June 16th by the University Press of Kentucky is the collection titled A Black Doe in the Anthropocene, Poems. We had a chance to speak by phone with Dr. White about that book and the importance of storytelling in her life and in ours.
I think that storytelling was multifaceted in my family, in particular on my father's side. And I want to preface this by saying that A Black Doe in the Anthropocene is based on a slave, oral slave narrative that I inherited from my mother. But on my father's side of the family, storytelling was also important. I had a grandmother who was a very good oral storyteller, And she would recount things from her childhood and, you know, different cultural moments that she experienced being out in the world as a Black woman. And being born in 1905, she experienced a lot of iterations of African-American history. So she was a very vivid storyteller. And it's something that she would do, like in the evenings when we were there in the summertime, all the cousins and aunts and uncles gathered around. It's something that she would do. Of course, growing up in the era where listening to radio was the big thing to do. And so oral storytelling for her generation was certainly a byproduct of what was available entertainment-wise during that era. As far as my mother's side of the family, this particular oral slave narrative was important for me and important for her when she inherited as a child from her own mother and then understood that she was in a long line of Harrisons who had passed this story along. So when she told me in a way that made me understand that this is how she had heard the story. And so I knew it was something very prized to hold on to. But I never put two and two together that this oral slave narrative was vitally connected to African American slave history. I thought it was just my family story. So when I heard about the larger story of American institutional slavery, I really did not, I think, understand how much of a gem I really had, because there are many people in the Black community who do not have that kind of oral inheritance. They always study it as this general history. But not only did I have this oral narrative, I later found out that indeed there were written records that corresponded to this oral narrative that I had inherited. And that's when I realized that indeed this was something very special and I needed to write about. All I needed to do was find the right genre in which to cast this story. And I spent quite a bit of time thinking about that. I tried to tell it first in prose, and I made some inroads there within an essay that I published. But I realized, because of the fragmented nature of the information, that the best way to write about it was through the genre of poetry. Again, this was my mother's side where I inherited the slave narrative. When she told me the story, I believed it. I believed it because she was the visible iteration of what transpired on the plantation. And to be more specific, my great-grandfather was born in 1865. He was the last member of our branch of the family, as far as I know, who was born on the plantation, where his ancestors had also been born and had lived. So she told me that his father was his master and his mother was an enslaved woman owned by that master. And he was very fair-skinned, fair enough to actually pass as a white man, but he lived as a Black man. This was my mother's grandfather, my great-grandfather. My mother is also a very fair-skinned woman, and many times she has been mistaken for someone other than Black. People have thought she was Portuguese or, you know, something other, and she would have to tell them, I am an African-American woman, or I am a Black woman, based on the time frame in which they asked the question. So she was the physical evidence of this, and she told me that the reason why she was so fair-skinned was because of this ancestry. So she gave me the oral story to explain her own, you know, complexion, because both of her parents were Black. They were not dark-skinned Black people, but they were visibly Black. But she was born fair-skinned with freckles and red hair. And so that's just genetics. You know, we know that sometimes a complexion pops up and it might have been, you know, a generation or two removed from the present. But when she told me the story, because of how she looks, I, of course, believed her. Now, later, there were other indications that this was a true story. The New York Times published an article in the late 80s that talked about my great-grandfather and his involvement in the Harrison family reunion. This is one of the largest family reunions in the country. that included both black and white Harrisons. So the name coming from that original Scottish immigrant in the 18th century who made his way to then British America and began to purchase land and African people to build a plantation empire. Eventually, members of the African community that he owned became blood relatives of that family because of plantation traditions, right, between masters and enslaved women or overseers and enslaved women.
And you have a poem toward the end, Slivers, which you mention of DNA, right? And you help us understand in poetic form about how close, 99%, but just the slivers. It's a very powerful poem that way. Why did you think that was a good way to bring everything to a close?
Well, it is one of the latter poems in the collection. There is one more poem after that one that is in the afterword. But I included this one near the end because it comes after I've told about all of this history. I've told about the slave receipt, the first slave receipt I came across in the collected plantation records that had Peter Harrison's name on it. And when my mother told me the oral slave narrative, she always gave me the name Peter Harrison. So it stuck in my mind. And so when I saw that receipt for the sale of a Negro woman and her child and the amount they were sold for, it really resonated within me because I realized that he had held that slip of paper back in the 18th century and maybe even had touched it, you know, after that as he collected his records together. Who knows? But I was touching it in the 21st century and his blood is still in within me, as is the blood of my African ancestors. You know, DNA tests have proved that I have blood from the British Isles within me. And so it was kind of like this full circle DNA moment when I held that piece of paper. And I realized that I'm telling all of this history. I finally get to the end of the collection. And all of it is based on this concept of race and racial difference. And really, you know, human beings are so similar to each other, and it's just like this 1% difference that, you know, affects complexion. Such a small number, and yet the history is so huge, and we're still encountering its residue today. So I felt that that particular poem made the point. Look at what it really all boils down to. You know, do you understand how we continue to complicate a situation that could be relegated to its proper place if we just were able to reconcile ourselves? That difference does not have to be that large.
And the word you've chosen, slivers, we might think of broken glass, shards of glass. I looked up the derivation for sliver, and its roots are in Middle English, meaning to cut, to cleave, to split up or off. So it does suggest division and separation, and it's a brilliant image and a title in that way. You mentioned the collection of papers and the receipt that you held in your hand in the 21st century, and you wanted us to not only hear of it, but to see it as well, didn't you?
I did. When I was working on this collection of poetry, and I would give some talks about it on academic campuses, you know, people were very interested in the project, I would show some of the photographs of materials that I had collected and photographs I had taken with me so I could continue writing and working on it, even when I wasn't at the repository. And people were fascinated because they had never seen a slave receipt before for a sale that had actually transpired. And I realized that while I had been delving into this material for a while, a lot of people have no reason to look up slave receipts, you know, or to really think about them. It gets into the detail of the slave system. And so I asked if when the book was published and I was talking in conversation with the marketing people, I asked if the text of the receipt could be placed on the cover of the book. as well as a detailed image on the inside cover, so that people could actually come face to face with the history in a way that they may have not encountered previously. And that's the one thing about looking at the archives. There's so much information that is contained in these small bits of paper. There really is. The fact that the woman is referred to as a Negro wench. You know, a lot of people feel that because they know that the N-word is something that came out of enslavement, that that's how enslaved people were always referred to. And that's not so. And so we see that on this receipt, yes, that language could have been used, but that is not what was used. The proper name for that time period was Negro to refer to Black people. And so even though there's the disrespect of not having the woman's name nor the name of her child, even the use of the term Negro lets us know that there was a way of managing business that was perhaps more professional than we might have thought without having that history and that receipt right in front of us.
And you also open some people's eyes, I'm sure, to the role that women slaveholders played. And you point out how they freed themselves in the process.
Yes, that's true. You know, there's now scholarship that really writes extensively about how white women were involved in the slave trade, that when they held property, they held wealth, and they could make a good marriage because of that property wealth. And if, you know, a husband died, they still, if they owned human property, they had wealth, and they could make a subsequent marriage based on that, or they could decide that they wanted to live independently and still be able to sustain themselves. So, yes, that's true.
And you've chosen different poetic forms when you want to focus a sestina, a sonnet, for instance, and other poetic forms to help contain the tension in what you're writing about.
Yes, you're right. It does serve to work that way when you're reading through the collection. I am telling the story. I use phonics very much, and metered verse is what that gives you. It gives you the sound of the history in different ways, right, because of the rhyme scheme. So it's a way of continuing to engage the reader, even though there is a lot of gravitas, a lot of seriousness about the subject matter. There is a lyricism, a musicality that is contained in metered verse, which I thought was really essential in dealing with this very serious history.
And I can imagine that when you do have a reading, that this is spellbinding because you are so conscious of the oral tradition of which you are a part as a poet. Even though these are poems in print, there's such musicality here that it must be something for us to be in your presence when you're reading these poems. Do you get that sense?
I do. When I have read them aloud, I mean, you could hear a pin drop. And then suddenly when I come to the end of the poem, people just erupt. And it's been amazing. So, yes, it does serve to operate that way when I'm presenting the material orally as well.
What's very interesting, Dr. White, is that you begin the collection not with Black history, but with the history of Indigenous peoples.
Wow. So having Native American blood is also a part of my family's narrative. And there was not a lot of information about that. So there's still a question mark as far as the particular nation that is represented in my genealogy. But what I noticed when I was in the region where my family was enslaved was a historical plaque regarding the Sara Indians. And it struck me that all of this time, people had talked about Native American blood as a part of our genealogy, but no one had talked about the various nations that were represented in that region of North Carolina. We hear so much about the Cherokee, but there were other nations that were there. And so one cannot assume that because that Cherokee is the nation we know the most about or we hear talked about the most, that you're descended from that particular people. And so I decided to write about the Sara, who were basically rendered extinct as a part of European colonialism. And they had to migrate, and the remaining number of people of that nation migrated to another region in order to survive, and their numbers were so small that they eventually were absorbed in large part into the nation that they also became appendage to. And so I said, let's frame it here, because African people were not the first feet to sift needle pine in that region, nor were Europeans, but it was the Sora. The Sora of Stokes County, North Carolina. For the Sora Indians, 1670 was the beginning of the end. Greensboro News and Record. Before sorrow, there were no diseases carried by settlers on southern breezes to cull a people, winnow thousands to hundreds, and birth fear of communal extinction. Before sorrow, there was no sign stating Upper Sora Town, a village of the Sora, abandoned by the tribe in the early 1700s, making me stop and think about first feet to sift needled pine until settlers from those British Isles ushered in the Sora's disease-ridden demise. Before sorrow, there was no ritual of living with the dead, because it was said they died too swiftly from an enemy groomed a pearled ocean away. Sorrow is a corpse bound and held close with breathless hope, a lost people, a broken homonym.
Thank you for reading that. You were saying it, speaking it from your heart clearly. And isn't it ironic that the name Sora, as you suggest, S-A-U-R-A, sounds like sorrow, S-O-R-R-O-W. So that's why you set it up that way. You also spend time in a section talking about repatriation, which is something that people realize but may not understand and may not recognize what the repercussions were when people set out the other way.
Yes. The amazing thing about the archives is you have in mind what you think you will find before you actually go. You start to fantasize, I'm going to find this, I'm going to find that. And that is not the reality. You know, you find what people have held on to. And so there are all of these unexpected stories. I knew about re-immigration to Africa via the American Colonization Society when I was in graduate school. I had come across a letter, actually, when I was at the University of Kentucky. And it was a once enslaved man who had been emancipated and had immigrated to this new colony called Kentucky in Liberia. And he was writing about his experiences there. And it was really amazing primary source. And I thought about it over the years. So when I was in the Harrison archives and I came across this letter freeing a family of black Harrisons so that they could immigrate to Liberia, I said, whoa, this is amazing. This is a part of perhaps, you know, my family history that I never would have imagined. And so I decided that because I'm writing this poetry collection and I want to say as much as possible about the complexity of enslavement, I have to include a section talking about repatriation to Africa for those black people who were already free, had never been enslaved, who made the decision to travel back to Africa so they could feel truly free and not face American racism that existed while the institution of enslavement existed. So they were free people, but they wanted to be even freer, thinking that if we go to a black nation, there we'll have no racism. And there were people who used the Underground Railroad to gain their freedom and then made that decision to emigrate for the same reason. There were also plantation owners, you know, masters, who were taught to about gradual abolition and were encouraged to free some of their enslaved people for this project of recolonization. And so that's what happened in this case. They were
freed, but slavery continued for, you know, their fellow enslaved on that particular plantation. The reason they were freed, perhaps family loyalty, there might have been any number of reasons why this particular family was freed, but they were. And so I had this letter that talked about them being freed, talked about them being supported in their immigration effort, given seeds so that they could begin farming and tools so they could begin farming once they arrived. So they were being financially set up to succeed once they arrived in Liberia. So that is part of the story of immigration, dealing with this parcel of Hairston's, but then dealing with the history of other people who made this decision, talking about what they found when they immigrated. They had high hopes, big dreams, and those dreams didn't always play out the way they imagined. Some people, when they arrived, found life so hard that they made the decision to come back because there was disease, malaria, that was not evident in the U.S., so they had no protection from it, and many of them perished because of it. Life was hard, starting from the ground up. It's not easy, especially in what, for some people, ended up feeling like a hostile nation. Their Black brethren did not live like they lived. They were basically seen as Black white men when they arrived because they had Western values. So there wasn't this grand homecoming that people expected. And so that, too, is a part of the history, the complex history of slavery.
And do you like sharing it with your students? Is it impactful? It's new, but have you with your students?
Well, when I talk about American slavery, I do use some of the records that I collected as a part of my PowerPoint slide presentations, and they're fascinated. Of course they are. When they've seen that receipt, they've been fascinated. When they've seen other materials like slave rosters and, you know, I have another poem where I talk about people's names as they're recorded, most frequently the first name, right, and the price that they were valued at. It really helps them to understand that this system was very detailed and was very specific. And the documentation brings it home to them in a way that it was never brought home before when they studied it. Students don't study American slavery very extensively, but they are given some information. But it literally blows their mind when they see that these records exist and what is contained in those records. It's inescapable. The system is inescapable in a way that it hasn't been for them previously. And so they feel liberated to then talk about it and ask more questions. And they're always thankful. I've had plenty of students say, thank you so much for talking about this history. I never knew it was this big. You know, they're appreciative because this too is a part of America. And they're proud of their country. But they're also proud to learn about the good, the bad, the complex, the difficult. They want to claim it all.
Let me just ask you about this collection at the University of North Carolina, these archives. How did they get there? How did these papers come to be preserved?
I think the last living member of that direct line in the White Hairston family made the decision to donate the archive because after his death, there wasn't really going to be a way of preserving it long term. And I think it was just a recognition that this needs to be where people can study it. It's not just about family records anymore. It's an important national history.
In writing this and immersing yourself in the archives and the stories of your own family in the context of the larger story, what are some of the senses of freedom that have come to you?
This book is also transhistorical. I have poems that talk about how we're wrestling with this history today in the U.S. And I use that commentary about the present day to say that at the end of it, we have to realize that there is value in human life. Every one of us is given a life to live. And the idea is not to encumber others so that they feel like they have to lay their lives on the line to fight a social battle. It shouldn't come to that. If we have respect for human life, then we can do anything. We can achieve anything. But just that recognition is so, so critical. And that's how I thought about it. People were enslaved, yet they still had dreams. Their dreams were about gaining their freedom. And if they could not gain the big freedom that they wanted away from those chains, then they accepted the small freedom of being able to name their children. If they were able to name their own children, pass down names. You know, my brother inherited the name of one of our ancestors. And that name inheritance helped me to recognize, when I looked at the historical record, who that early ancestor was. Just the passing down of that simple name. And so there was a freedom in that. And so, you know, looking today at how the plantation operates in society, thinking about that, one of the things I always wondered was why people would want to marry on a plantation because of that history. I do believe that they should exist because people can go through and have a tour and actually see what the material life of an enslaved person was like, what the material life of a plantation master was like. But, you know, there are also things that we need to think consciously about that we're doing. Is it appropriate based on that history? Is it more important to have the wedding, or is it more important to study the history and to some way empathize transhistorically with that? That is a freedom, the ability to face this history, accept that it happened, and give it its proper acknowledgement. There's freedom in that, instead of trying to run away from it or camouflage it into something that it really shouldn't be. So, yes, it made me think about freedom in all sorts of ways. And I hope that when people read the text, that's how they'll feel. They'll feel liberated through knowledge.
Artress Bethany White, award-winning author and associate professor of English at East Stroudsburg University, speaking with us about her new collection titled Black Dough in the Anthropocene, Poems, issued on June 16th by the University Press of Kentucky. For more information about Dr. White, you can visit her website, artressbethanywhite.com, A-R-T-R-E-S-S, artressbethanywhite.com. And you can find the collection online and regionally at the End Bookstore in Allentown and Carol and Carol Booksellers in Stroudsburg. Again, it is Black Dough of the Anthropocene, Poems, published by the University Press of Kentucky, artressbethanywhite.com.